Good morning or good afternoon. Welcome to Swiss Re's 2018 Annual Report Conference Call. Please note that today's conference call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to John Dacey, Group CFO. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, or again, good morning to those of you dialing in from the Americas, and welcome to today's Q&A call. I'm here with Patrick Raflub, our Group Chief Risk Officer, and Edmund Courton, the Head of Actuarial P&C Control. And of course, Philip Ryan is here as the Head of Investor Relations. Today, we publish the 2018 annual report, which includes our corporate responsibility report, providing overall more than 500 pages of corporate disclosure. For your convenience, we've prepared a presentation with an extract on our economic results, the group's economic solvency and capital generation, and our P&C loss ratio development triangles. We will not go through today's presentation slide by slide, but rather highlight the most important elements. Having said that, we're happy to address any questions you might have during the Q&A session. So if I can bring you to the extract report. Starting with slide three, we reiterate the importance and relevance of EVM at Swiss Re. This is our proprietary integrated economic valuation framework, which forms the basis for our business steering and allows consistent measurement of our performance on an economic basis. It also forms the basis for deciding on our capital actions. We've developed and used the EVM for the last 15 years. Slide 5 shows our track record of economic earnings calculated as the sum of EVM profit and capital cost release to shareholders, the cost of debt and additional taxes. Within the EVM profit, you see the strong contribution of EVM new business profit, mainly driven by our life and health and P&C reinsurance businesses. The EVM investment profits are evaluated on a risk-adjusted basis after taxes and capital cost. They are inherently more volatile as they reflect market movements. EVM explicitly recognizes opportunity costs for shareholder capital. That is why the total contribution to economic net worth is the total return generated for shareholders, or what we call our economic earnings. It's a key element of our capital generation. Over the last 5 years, the average economic earnings of the group have been $3.4 billion, supporting the capital generation and capital actions of Swiss Re. If I can take you forward to slide 8, you have a reiteration of the group's over-the-cycle financial targets and how we have fared against those. After a series of outperformance, 2017 and 18 were two challenging years, the costliest and fourth costliest years for the insurance industry with respect to large losses. In 2017, we still met our economic net worth per share growth target. In 2018, the combination of higher than expected large losses and the negative impact stemming from financial market movements led to our performance being below the targeted levels. We remain focused on these targets. Moving to the group's 2018 EVM results on slide 11, you can see the key EVM figures. Our economic earnings were $2.2 billion, despite the impact of the large nat cat and man-made losses, the credit spreads widening, and negative equity market performance. I would like now to move to the next section of the presentation and speak about our group SST ratio, which we published today, as well as our capital generation. On slide 17, you see that our 2019 group SST ratio stands at 251%, which reflects our attractive capital repatriation, including the 2019 regular dividend and 90% of the first tranche of the proposed share buyback program. We remain comfortably above the 220% target. Slide 19 is another slide I'd like to highlight in this introduction, as it illustrates the resilience and strength of our capital position under various market stress scenarios. We remain above our group target ratio level under any of these considered scenarios. On slide 20, we show the moving parts for the group SST ratio. You can see the impact of our economic earnings, the capital we deployed in the business through our P&C renewals, the growth in life and health reinsurance, and finally, the impact of our deleveraging and our strong capital repatriation to shareholders. Slide 21 illustrates our economic earnings, how our economic earnings have driven our strong capital generation over the last 5 years. With $2.6 billion generated annually and ultimately supporting the peer-leading capital repatriation of Swiss Re. We have also updated the overview of dividend upstreams for the group on slide 23. The overall capital repatriation for the 5 years 2014 to 2019 now amounts to $14 billion U.S. dollars. With that quick introduction, I'll pass over to Patrick Raflob, our group CRO, for the remainder of this introduction.
Thank you, John, and good day also from my side. We also published our loss ratio development triangles today, and I will briefly provide you with some remarks on those, starting on slide 24 of the presentation. As you know, our reserves are set on a best estimate basis with a robust process and controls which remain unchanged. On slide 25, you can see that the Swiss Re Group remains prudently reserved in the upper half of the range of best estimates between the 60th and the 80th percentile. This is true for our group reserves as a whole, but also for recent underwriting years and has consistently been the case over more than 15 years now. The reduction in reserve releases for the most recent years is driven by motor and liability lines. In particular, and as previously flagged, in 2018, we strengthened liability reserves mainly due to a large one-off settlement related to a very old contract on which we experienced late reported claims. The underwriting years 2015 to 2017 have been strengthened in some cases on a preemptive basis and in some regions partly due to observed increases to claims frequency and due to adverse actual versus expected claims in general. For such recent underwriting years, the IBNR is still a big portion of the total ultimate loss. We continuously refine and improve our reserve setting approach and have made several adjustments this year. I would limit my remarks to this, but I'm here in the room with our head of P&C Actuarial Control, Edmund Cartoon, and we are happy to address any questions that you may have. With that, I will hand over to Philippe Brahin, head of Investor Relations, who will guide us through Q&A.
Thank you, Patrick and John, and good day to all of you also from my side. So as usual, before we start our Q&A session, I would like to remind you to please restrict yourselves to two questions each and register again if you have follow-up questions. So with that, operator, could we please take the first question?
The first question is from the line of Vikram Gandhi from Societe Generale. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, it's Vic from SocGen. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Firstly, I see a pretty significant increase in the 200-year PMLs YOY, and given data from January renewals and potentially higher CAT exposures through the mid-year renewals, I wondered if the group is contemplating any change to its retro strategy. Secondly, can you just give us a sense of how much the excess fat is at the reinsurance unit in terms of the capital? The reason is P&C Re has upstreamed quite a lot over the past couple of years with literally very little earnings, and today we see another $1.7 billion tabled for approval, although I appreciate that's a combination of both P&C and life and health units. So that's all from my side. Thank you.
Thanks, Vikram. So maybe we start with John, at exposure, retro.
Yeah, so I think you're right that we have been successful in writing some very interesting new business at the beginning of the year. We look to continue to build our Nat Cat book if, in fact, we find ourselves on certain peak risks at a level which we would otherwise find somewhat uncomfortable, then we would potentially be prepared to use retro to manage that those positions. I can say at this moment that what we have on our books today is comfortable for us to maintain. On your second question with respect to SRZ, I think we've disclosed, actually conveniently, in the context of a debt issuance which went out today, our SST ratio for 2019 for SRZ at 218%. That's down on the year, as you indicated, partly because of strong dividends up, but it remains very, very strong over any actual requirement. I think the total, if you did the math, you'd find it probably something like $14 billion U.S. dollars above 100% requirement. So as a unlisted 100% owned subsidiary, we're very comfortable with the continuing capital level of SRZ.
Thanks, Vikram, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from the line of Andrew Ritchie from Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Two questions. First of all, on Life Capital, why did the contribution from new business go down when the volumes of new business went up? And maybe if you could differentiate between the front book of Life Capital and any new business associated with the back book. Second question on reserves. I can see the stronger loss picks or the higher ULRs for motor books, liability books, also I think A&H books, including workers' comp. I guess what surprises me is, having made the decision to strengthen the three most recent accident years, your opening loss pick for 2018 looks very low, much lower than 17 for all those three books. Now, is that just a seasoning thing because you haven't earned much of 18 yet, or the text refers to mix changes? What is so different about the mix of your 18 book for those classes than the previous years?
Thanks, Andrew. Why don't we start with reserves? Maybe Edmond is with us in the room, as Patrick mentioned.
Yep. So on the reserves, I mean, you're right. The 2018 loss pick is lower than other years, other adjacent years, mainly because 2016 and 17, those 2 years, we had a large multi-year whole account quota share written with one of our cedents, which was not up to renewal. And that allowed us, basically, that was quite a large contribution, and that allowed us to be able to have a lower loss pick for 2018. There's also other reasons on motor, for example, where on motor, we had historically, I think, Asia property, for example, reduced the volume proportional business in Asia since 2013, slightly reducing the volume of proportional business, which then increased naturally a little bit the size of non-proportional on the motor side. Yeah? So there's different reasons for different portfolios.
Okay, and then on your first question, I'll ask John.
Vis-a-vis Life Capital, yeah. So, Andrew, a very astute question. We've got a slightly different treatment between U.S. GAAP and our EVM on the LNG transaction. For U.S. GAAP, this was booked in the Q1 of 2018. It actually came in the Q4 of 2017 for EVM and thus inflated those numbers up. And when you do the year-on-year comparison, I think you're missing the fact that that was a positive in 17, not replicated in 18.
All right. Thanks, Andrew, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from William Hawkins from KBW. Please go ahead.
Hello. Thank you very much. Just trying to understand the relationship between your EVM and some of your SST figures, please, particularly for Life Capital. We know that your economic net worth was $3.3 billion. Can you try and help me understand what the SST NAV or risk-bearing capital is for that number? The reason I'm asking is because, as you know, at the group level, there are big differences between economic net worth and SST, even though economic net worth is the basis. So whilst you've got $36 billion of group ENW, your risk-bearing capital is $40-odd billion, so it's considerably higher. So can I just prorate that, or can you help me understand what the solvency capital is for Life Capital? And then secondly, very similar, what is the required capital for Life Capital? Again, we only know the group figure. Related to that question, could you, now you've given us the figures, maybe talk a bit more clearly about what would be the impact if you got to deconsolidate that business from your SST ratio? And in the back of my mind there, you've emphasized the benefit of deconsolidating Reassure. But I'm also sort of trying to understand what will be the offset, because I'm assuming the regulator is going to require you to add back some kind of equity charge. And it would be strange if you had too much of a benefit simply from deconsolidating a business. Thank you.
So William, I'm going to defer a little bit the first question. While we have disclosed in relation to the subordinated debt issuance, the SST on SRZ, we did not disclose for the other subsidiaries. In April, we will come back out in the financial condition report with some details around all three business units. And if I can ask you to wait for us, I think you'll get most of the answers you're looking for on Life Capital and the SST numbers in that disclosure. Is the first part. On the second part, with respect to the potential benefit on the deconsolidation, our expectation is, were we to drop our ownership of Reassure down just below 50%, call it 49, we're likely to have a look-through treatment for the risks of Reassure and the calculation of our Swiss solvency. And so instead of what now is a 75% ownership of that business, we would have a 49% ownership of the business, but the asset risks and other risks associated with Reassure would still come through into the calculation. There will be some point, and I don't know exactly what that point is, because FINMA is being, as a good regulator, a little less than perfectly transparent about where it triggers, that this would transform from a look-through approach to a simple equity charge, and we would have a position in a liquid equity group with the well-understood charges that the SST framework places on that. It would be a big swing, and we'd be subject to the volatility of that share price over time.
Thanks, William, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from the line of Mint Malhotra from Mediobanca. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you. So two questions. One is on SST. The other one is EVM earnings related, please. So the SST question is relating to the market value margin. Very substantial increase, because if we adjust, I mean, if this increase didn't happen, the SST might even have been, say, 10 points lower. But I'm just trying to understand what drove this increase. You have written the growth in Asia, but, I mean, in terms of dollar premiums, the PNC was flat and Life Re was 7% at the group level. Is that what really drives this? And then can this now MVM remain where it is? So that is the MVM topic. And second thing is just on the EVM earnings, and I'll try to see if you can address Life and PNC, but let's try at least one. The PNC Re has a very strong prior year earnings of $698 million on slide 11. And, you know, just the prior year development hasn't been obviously as high in the US GAAP terms in terms of PYD at least. Could you help us understand, is there something more in this? And I do appreciate that there is, I mean, even in the past, the US GAAP and EVM hasn't always had a very, very correlation. So I'll stick to these two. Thank you.
Shervin, happy to help. On the MVM, you're right. We did refer to our life and health reinsurance business. Actually, it was largely driven by a new business written in Asia across multiple markets, not a single market, on critical illness. And that's is required an adjustment of probably close to the full billion that you see moving up here. There are some other pieces, plus and minuses, but the a strong growth of what we believe is a long-term valuable business for us in the Asian markets, between a transaction and support for some of our core clients across Hong Kong, China, Korea, and Japan, have all resulted in an increase, as you say, of about $1 billion in the MVM adjustment. With respect to the prior year development, for P&C Re, that was more positive under EVM than it has been under the U.S. GAAP. The U.S. GAAP numbers have been brought through into EVM as well, but the main difference there is just the change in the capital requirements for prior years and some adjustments on the payout patterns, which we think have been positive on those prior year reserves. So we're comfortable with those amounts, but it's related to capital and payout patterns, not that we had any specific losses which came through one and not the other.
Thanks, Vinit, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Sami Taipalus from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi. thanks for taking my question. The first one, just on the reserving side. In the reinsurance liability proportional book, you've had, some additional adverse development, both on some recent years and then a little bit on some of the older years as well. Could you just talk through what was new in 2018 on that? I know these have been developing adversely in previous years as well, but just what was the new element there? And then the second question I have is coming back to the financial strength in SRZ. I think you mentioned a $14 billion surplus, but what's the binding constraint here? I guess on the regulatory view, but what is actually the binding constraint for that business? How much surplus do you think you have on that view? Thank you.
Thanks, Amin. We start with reserves with you, Edmond, yeah?
There's nothing really new to the previous trends that we've observed in 2018. What we've started to see already in 2017 basically continued. We've seen a little bit more increase in the frequency of some claims. We also had on the liability side, several man-made losses. So it is really a combination of the previous trends we've seen plus individual large losses, which resulted in an adverse development on the prior years for liability.
And on SRZ binding?
SRZ binding, I'd like to say, Sammy, that our reinsurance CEO, Moses, will be happy that you asked the question so we can clarify that we don't expect a $14 billion dividend up from the subsidiary. There are other constraints that we pay attention to in the context of both liquidity and capital. Rating agency's view of that business, and I think we can safely say that the actual binding constraint is quite some distance from that $14 billion, but we've not disclosed actual numbers. But again, the indication of the dividends to be paid gives you a sense of what we believe to be a healthy balance sheet and very unencumbered liquidity at this point in time, and we're comfortable expecting continued strong dividends from our reinsurance operations.
Thanks, Amy, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Frank Kopfinger from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. I have a follow-up on Will's question regarding the deconsolidation process of ReAssure. As you described that there is a two-step approach, at some point it will change from this look-through to the equity charge. However, my question would be also whether we should think at this point, once you only have this equity charge, whether there's some sort of offset in terms of additional capital requirements, some sort, or whether we really should expect the full release, so to say. And then secondly, also on the 200-year NatCat event, as Atlantic hurricane increased significantly, also California earthquake increased, my question would be whether how should we think about your NatCat budget, and what is the current number?
Thanks, Frank. So maybe John on the consolidation.
Yeah. So again, I think while it might be useful mentally to think about this in multiple steps, we're not predicting the outcome of the IPO in any way. We simply said that it's our objective to be able to deconsolidate. We'll see what market demand is at the point of time that we decide to announce. But you could imagine a range of outcomes in the first case. In the second case, there will be this point where we get to a level that's low enough for it to be treated as equity, but there will be a capital charge for equity. So while we won't have the look-through anymore, that equity charge will be there. Given the nature of the balance sheet of ReAssure and given the relative importance at the moment of financial market risk and credit risk in our calculations, I would expect us to have a better treatment and a lower capital under an equity investment than a look-through position at the same ownership level. And so that will be a benefit for us, the amount of which is probably premature to quantify.
And then on the NatCat exposure and NatCat budget, John?
Help me out, Philippe.
I think Eddie mentioned it, right? We talked about it in February when we came out with our full year results, saying, if, of course, our exposure increased. And you can see that today with the annual report in the stress test we are publishing. But we will come back to you, Frank, with the NatCat budget with our Q1 results. That's what we said. So you have to be a little bit patient with us. So in few weeks. Okay, thank you, Frank, for your question. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from James Shuck from Citi. Please go ahead.
Hello. Good afternoon, everybody. So my two questions. Firstly, I'm just looking at the accident year developments reported in the accounts. So I can see that there's been positive PYD on property and on specialty, but there's been negative on casualty and on the life and health re. I think the casualty one you've kind of largely explained, but I'm just interested to see the negative development on life and health re, given that that's been a book that you've been growing pretty aggressively in recent times. I think the triangles show me just the long tail development, and I'm just struggling to see the years it actually is coming from that drives that $249 million of adverse development. Second question, I guess the combined ratio guidance you've given for 2019 of 98%, that's about a point better on the original guidance for 2018. The casualty combined ratio, though, has been consistently above 100. So I think we did about 110, 111 in 2018. And again, that's been driven by some adverse development on the large contracts. But presumably that number is going to normalize. And I guess, if you're expecting casualty PYD to revert to a neutral position at worst, then I guess just the mix of impact as that casualty combined ratio gets better would suggest a group combined ratio getting better by more than 1 point. So if you just help me with my understanding a little bit there, please, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Maybe we start with Edmond on the accident year.
Yeah. So, I mean, on the accident year, you have to keep in mind that whatever is reported on the life and health reinsurance, it's not really the same thing as P&C, mainly because on the life and health side, the reserves that you have here are mainly disability life reserves, and you will, the way we report things, you will always be seeing some PYD on this business as the active life reserves basically become disabled. So you will always see that phenomenon. So the comparison between P&C and life and health is not really meaningful in that sense. So you can't compare those two things. Yeah. The 249 also is made of various moving pieces, some positives, some negatives, offsetting each other marginally. Then the other question was
casualty.
Well, around the casualty, yes. I mean, yes. I mean, casualty. You're right. There might be at some point some normalization of the loss ratio, but what we can say as of now is we're prudently reserved. We don't expect, we don't plan for any positive development in the reserves or negative development in the reserves, and we reserve at the best estimate. So the view that we have now is what we call this best estimate, and that's the what we call our view of the reserves.
But James, maybe to go a little further, I think bringing that estimate of the underlying or normalized rate down to 98 reflected both the strong renewals on that cap, but also recognition that we also increased our casualty book on January 1. The nature of the casualty that we wrote, in particular with a large transaction, was different in kind, I think, than our average book. It's a shorter duration, and so it's reasonable to expect that if we brought that on thinking it's creating value for us, it will have a lower combined ratio than the average casualty book that we have, which tends to be fairly long. So I think, again, we're comfortable that in spite of that $1 billion transaction, we're heading in the right direction on the combined ratio estimate for 2019, and we'll see how the year plays out.
Thanks, James, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Thomas Fossard, HSBC. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. I've got one question for probably for John on the dividend policy of the group. John, when I'm listening to your GAAP earnings call, actually you came with a 12% DPS, and you mentioned the rebasing effort that the group did in 18, and implicitly not encouraging us to expect the same DPS growth going forward. Now, where I'm hearing and listening to your EVM disclosure, and the message I'm getting is that the economic earnings is the right benchmark to, you know, gauge going forward. So what's going to be the best proxy to gauge the dividend policy of the group as you're steering the company on an economic basis? So 2.2 this year, normalized 2.9, average 3.4. So, I mean, all that is pointing to confidence in growing the economic earnings of the group going forward. So we should lead to better growth and in dividend expectations. So maybe I'm wrong, but I'm a bit confused because it seems to be that, you know, there is a kind of discrepancy in terms of message, either you when you're talking about GAAP numbers or when you're talking about economic numbers. So, I mean, anything you can say or explain on how to look at things on these two different metrics? Thank you.
Sure. So it's not our intention to confuse people about the dividend policy. What I think you're referring to, the slide in the deck that we used, probably that's the best reference point is slide 21, where we talk about net solvency capital generation. In the middle of the page, it's something like 8 francs per share on average over the last 5 years. That is an average, and it has been both above and below that number. We think over a period of time, that's a reasonable position. What we said with our dividend increase this year, the 12% increase from 5 to 5.6, which is being recommended to the AGM, is that we're confident that we should be able to continue from that point a reasonable dividend policy, which says the dividend is highly unlikely to ever have to go down from there. And from that point, we should be able to manage reasonable increases over time. What I warn people is not to expect a 12% increase year on year for near term years. Now, if it turns out that we're highly successful in the context of the underwriting of 19 and 20, we'll reevaluate that at this year end and going forward. But at least for now, I think what the economic results EVM released today shows is that this wasn't false bravado in moving ourselves to 560, but supported by strong underlying economics. That's our new base, and we'll continue from there.
Thanks, Thomas, for your question. Can we have the next one, please?
The next question is a follow-up from Vinit Malhotra. Please go ahead.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. So just as I was saying, my question was related to the Life Re and a bit linking it to the SST sensitivities. So slide number 13, John says that there was an impact, a negative impact on the investment EVM investment income from rising interest rates from net long duration in Life Re. But equally, slide 19 suggests that the SST benefits from rising interest rates. So as we go into the year, and one reason I'm asking this question is because I'm trying to figure out what the solvency would look like in various scenarios, but as we go into this year, how should we be thinking about interest rates and life and SST and these two slides together? Thank you.
Yeah, so I think if you come back to 13, you do see, in fact, that there was an investment loss due to the rising interest rates of the net long position. The sensitivities, so this is our EVM framework. There are some differences in the treatment between EVM and SST for changes in interest rates. And so the best way for you to think about what might be happening and what might have already happened, frankly, in 2019 would be to go to slide 19 on the SST, and that will show the sensitivities for our SST positions. I think these on the credit spreads in particular were demonstrated to be an accurate indication of how far we would go as spreads blew out in the fourth quarter of 2018. I think with interest rates and with credit spreads having changed directions, or credit spreads in particular changed directions in the first 2.5 months of this year, you would see a reversal of maybe not exactly the same size, but a large part of what happened. So in terms of your objective to find or to estimate our SST ratios going forward, I'd focus you on 19 and understand that on 13, the EVM calculations have a different basis for this. And that's why we've separated the two segments to try to help you understand those differences. Patrick, I don't know if you wanted to add anything.
No, just to add, so the main reason for interest rate sensitivity of the SST ratio is the market value margin, especially the MVM, especially in the long tail, and all the other components are actually fairly well matched from an interest rate sensitivity perspective.
Thank you, Vinit, for your question. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is a follow-up from William Hawkins. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. Sorry to drag the call out. On slide 11, John, what should we think is a normal EVM profit on investments? I'm not quite familiar about how to think about it. On the one hand, if that figure is, strictly speaking, your alpha against a neutral benchmark, should I just be plugging in a zero unless I think you guys are sort of brilliant fund managers? Or is it a figure that is inevitably going to exaggerate just market movements to the extent that you're always long market risk? So in a good year, it's going to be up a lot, as it was in 17. In a bad year, it's going to be down a lot. I'm not quite sure what you would suggest I kind of plug in if I'm thinking about a normal year. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure our chief investment officer would like you to think that he's brilliant, but I think in the context of this modeling, aiming towards zero is a reasonable starting point, is probably the best place to be. The volatility, I think, will be there. It's not obvious to me that it's going to be dramatically more than market moves, and I think you just have to evaluate from which direction performance is moving. We've now reduced, at least at the moment, our exposure to equities, at least at year end 2018, they were materially down, partly from markets themselves. We've maintained through the 2018 a fairly conservative positioning on risk assets, and I think the fact that these numbers weren't worse reflects that.
Thanks, William, for your follow-up question. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is a follow-up from James Shuck. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my follow-up. I just want to return to the SST target range or the target level you have. So the 220 ceiling, John, I think you've been pretty clear that you will look to manage down towards that level, in the near term. So, by that, I assume, within the next 2 to 3 years, you would manage that SST down towards kind of around the 220% level instead of kind of the 250 level. And I guess within, when you think about that, as you deconsolidate ReAssure over time, then presumably the level of risk and the level of volatility that's needed within that ratio also comes down. So is the 220 itself still going to be valid post ReAssure? Thank you.
So maybe if I can add a little bit of clarifications. I don't believe that I said we're aiming to bring the group's capital down to 220 in the near term. I think we said we reiterate that that's our long-term target. I think that you've seen that in spite of a modest downward move year on year from 269 to 251, we're continuing fairly shareholder-friendly capital actions, both the increase of the dividend, the commitment to the first tranche of $1 billion, and the potential for the second tranche, depending on our overall capital positions later this year. So I think, market conditions as well as potential business opportunities will influence the speed with which we come towards 220. At the moment, I think everyone around both the executive committee and the board is comfortable with a robust balance sheet. There are a lot of things going on in the world on a macroeconomic level, which make us believe there's utility in maintaining this balance sheet strength. I'd also say the success we had at the beginning of this year in terms of renewal leads us to think that there might be some interesting opportunities during the rest of 19 and into 20 for continual underwriting of profitable business. And if we can deploy capital in that direction, we will, which by itself would bring us towards 220, but without any specific capital repatriation.
Thanks, James, for your follow-up question. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Andrew Ritchie. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Sorry. Two very quick follow-ups. This is probably a naive question, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. Why did your SST requirement for non-life only grow 4%, but the PML for a 1 in 200 Atlantic, just to pick one scenario, grew about 30%? Is that just the magic of diversification, or what? I'm just surprised the SST requirement didn't grow more. And just to clarify, the SST requirement and the PML is a forward-looking number. It reflects already any growth of Nat Cat exposure that took place in January 19. And the other question was, in your introductory comments, there was a comment that you're constantly refining your approach to reserving. I think those are the words you used. And you would, what did you do? What was any change in broad approach in 2018? Thanks.
Yeah, so, Andrew, I can take your first question. So, indeed, it is the effect of diversification, especially the NatCat peak risks diversify fairly well. And that's really the long and the short of the explanation. Edmund?
Yeah. Well, on the reserving, I mean, indeed, we constantly refine and revise the way we do reserving. I mean, reserving is not something which is fixed. The segmentation we use is not something which is fixed. So what we did mainly last year in terms of reserving enhancement or update to our model was on the UK PPO, where we updated the way we applied the mortality assumption. In the past, we used a multiplicative approach to how to apply the impairment modificator. And last year, we decided to use an additive approach, whereby it was more accurately reflecting the fact that when somebody has suffered an accident and the longer he was living, the longer his life expectancy was getting closer to somebody who was an unimpaired life, basically. We did also other modifications on the workers' comp in the US. We also started to use life and health techniques in order to assess the tail factor for these portfolios. Some other enhancements were, for example, on credit and surety, where we also enhanced the way that we do reserving by having a recosting of the initial expected loss ratio using the costing tools. So we're combining a bit more the costing experience, the costing tools together with the reserving. I can go on with different techniques, but I think that's enough. Yeah.
Andrew, I think the overriding important message is constantly looking at specific technical approaches for specific sub portfolios, but in the general reserving orientation, absolutely no change. Complete stability in both our objective to be correctly and prudently reserved.
Thanks, Andrew, for your follow-up question. That was actually our last question. So we come to the end of our Q&A. Many thanks to Edmond, Patrick, and John. If you have any follow-up questions, don't hesitate to reach out to any member of the IR team. Thank you again, all of you, for joining today. Operator, back to you.
Thank you for participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.